News, sports, weather from Dr. Bill Williams, traffic info from Kane, and one of the Gulf Coast's most familiar voices. It's Mobile Mornings with Dan Brennan and Dalton Arwig.
Morning from Dan and Dalton on FM Talk 106.5, Mobile Mornings, 8:07. Special guest Brian Comer is in the studio. We're glad to have him, and because there's been so much going on, Dalton, with especially, I guess, since the turn of the month, the Supreme Court, they've been busy, they've been active, they have been vocal, and we're trying to make sense of all of it.
Yeah, because you see the headlines come out.
Yeah, exactly.
Major Trump win. Ooh, major Trump loss from this decision. And everyone goes, hey, or boo. But there's a whole lot more to a lot of these, and including some cases that we've been paying attention to how it might affect Alabama down the line. But Brian Comer with Tobias and Comer Law is in studio with us again to really hold our hands through some of these opinions that have been put out there and let us know what they really mean. Brian, thanks again for coming in, man.
Yeah, good morning. Appreciate y'all having me.
Yeah, we love having you.
Yeah, so we know, you know, just a few weeks ago, maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, had a big Friday where the Supreme Court, just before the end of their term, put out some big rulings. But then we've even seen a couple more since then, including a ruling this week. And this ruling on federal workforce reductions, that, of course, was a plank of the Trump campaign and what they said they were going to do when they came in. And we saw a lot of roadblocks put into place from that. You have unions who aren't happy about it as well, obviously. But that ruling came out this week, or I say ruling. We've seen the court in several cases punt, or we've seen them send it back to lower court. So kind of explain the federal workforce reductions ruling that they came out with this week.
Sure. This is a direct result of DOGE, or is it?
You know, that's a good question. I believe it has to do with the DOGE initiative. I didn't read the briefing from the parties. But, yeah, I mean, it's that same concept that they're wanting to essentially downsize the federal workforce.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to get there, we need a little bit of background, and we can put it in context. But let's address it head on first. So what we have is an opinion that came out on July the 8th. And it's what is referred to from the shadow docket or the emergency docket. And it's something that's really ramped up in recent years, really from the first Trump administration. But I'll get into how it's different from the typical what they call merits docket, where you see oral argument and all that sort of thing. So what happened is you had in the Trump v. AFGE opinion, again, it came out on July the 8th, it's a procedural issue. So what we have is, this executive order gets issued, and the district court issued a stay for it. And I believe it was in the Northern District of California, so San Francisco. The judge said, hang on a second, you know, we think that this is overstepping federal authority or the president's executive power. And so they issued...
Haven't heard of that before.
Yeah, well, and so what they did is they issued an injunction, and we're going to talk about equitable relief a little bit later, but basically to say time out. You know, let's figure this out. Is the judge, or excuse me, is the executive order too overreaching? And if so, we're going to address it. Well, so essentially what this is just a procedural ruling by the Supreme Court in the shadow docket. So there has been no oral argument. There has been no conference where the justices figure out, you know, who's voting what way, all that sort of thing. All this is it saying, look, the injunction is stayed, meaning timeout on the timeout or game on until it's properly heard both at the district court level and then by the Court of Civil Appeals at the Ninth Circuit. And so then what the court specifically said, and interestingly, it came into Justice Kagan, and then ultimately Justice Sotomayor concurred, and you know, with her ideological lean, you know, one would think that she might go the other direction on this. But she said in her short concurrence that the relevant executive order directs agencies to plan reorganizations and reductions in force consistent with applicable law. And so basically what they're saying is, look, let's see how this goes, and then we'll make our final decision on it in the merits stage of it.
Once people can actually argue their case.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's an interesting position because opponents of it, and like Justice Jackson wrote the 16-page dissent.
Yeah, was not Sotomayor very kinda critical of Jackson?
I thought
she?
So, yeah. Yeah.
There has been an uptick, it seems,
in drama,
in the rhetoric,
yeah,
this term in particular, and the CASA case we'll talk about in a second. She got called out by name, but basically what the opponents are saying is, look, you can't unscramble the egg. If you go in and you have a reduction in force and you fire 20,000 people or, yeah, something, services are off and all that. And so then what if 3 years from now, when we go through due process, what if the court ultimately rules that the Trump administration or exceeded its authority, then what? But you know, procedurally, that's where it is, and that's the opinion.
And you were showing me the differences in size of the opinions when it's something that's been worked through in the shadow docket, mm-hmm, or with the merits docket. Like you said, you get time to argue, and it just goes on, and you see news article after news article of how they may or may not rule.
Right.
But you were also saying that, especially during the Trump terms, there's been a major increase on these emergency hearings from the court, right?
Yeah, and that was something that really started. I don't have all the stats in front of me, but during Trump's first term, basically, it used the shadow docket more to get an emergency stop. Basically, mm-hmm, exactly what we're talking about here, where a lower court has ruled that the executive authority has been exceeded. That also had a huge uptick in Biden's term, and now there were 56 opinions. Excuse me, that was on the merits docket. There are 113 cases currently on the shadow docket. 44 were decided last year. So, I mean, that's almost triple what we saw from last year.
A massive increase, which makes sense when you think of some of these executive orders or things that may happen, and they need to act quick, or they need a ruling quickly,
right,
just to know how to proceed.
Right.
So we're seeing an increase of that because there have been a whole lot more executive actions as well, and people who are upset with executive actions.
Yeah, and let me kind of take a step back to kind of remind us of what we've got here. We're talking about the merits docket versus the shadow docket, mm-hmm, or emergency docket, as they call it. And so with the merits docket, that's what we typically think of and say, okay, briefing gets filed. There's a term out there, amicus curiae, friends of the court can file briefs to say, hey, I'm not a party to this, but I have an interest in seeing what happens. I'm, mm-hmm, going to write on it. That's where you have oral argument. The process is actually a really fascinating process to me. I get, mm-hmm, I nerd out on this stuff. But after the oral arguments happen, the justices meet the following, like 2 days later, and they have a conference. And in that conference, it's just them.
Mm.
And the nine of them say their piece about each case. They vote. And then ultimately, whoever's in the majority, if the chief is in the majority, he assigns who writes the opinion. If he's not in the majority, the most senior person writes, picks who writes the opinion. And so that's how the typical opinions come out, versus the shadow docket, where you have an emergency application that's filed here mostly by the government to say, hang on a second, this has been stopped. We want to be able to use it.
Got it. So the Louisiana redistricting case,
mm-hmm,
pretty similar to Alabama, basically. In a lot of ways, what happened in Louisiana shadowed what happened here in Alabama, or vice versa. Yes?
Yeah, well, so it's a similar issue. It is looking at the creation of a particular House district.
To favor a Democrat or black.
Well, a more African-American majority district.
District, right.
So you don't have some kind of gerrymandered, mm-hmm, kind of thing. Yes.
And so what they did here, and like Dan was saying, all eyes in Alabama were on this to see how it might affect our state and affect congressional redistricting, which could swing the House. So you've got people on both sides who are very interested in this, but, mm-hmm, in this particular case, it really seemed like the Supreme Court punted, right?
Yeah, so the yes is the short answer.
Okay.
So, you know, they only have so much time, and, yeah, they only have so many resources, and,
sure,
they had some really heavy issues that they had to handle this year. But between all these emergency filings, so you still have to research them, you still have to come up with a conclusion, and the opinions that got issued this year. I think there were 58 opinions that came out this year in the merits docket. They just ran out of time.
Wow.
And so the only really hard and fast rule that they follow, I mean, there's rules, obviously, but the one that matters in the releasing of opinions is to get them out by the end of June.
Yes.
And so if they couldn't get to it, if they couldn't give it the due time it deserved, which appears to be the case here,
okay.
They have a couple of options here. And I actually was following a case several years ago. You know, we follow these cases closely, too, because they affect our clients and affect our practice. There was one where they just said, you know what, the writ of certiorari, which y'all may remember from last time in the conversation, mm-hmm. that's how you appeal to the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. It was improvidently granted. And so we're going to say, nope, we shouldn't have granted cert. We're kicking it back to whatever the lower court said holds. Here, what they said was basically we ran out of time.
Wow.
We're going to do arguments again. We have additional questions we want to ask, and in due course, we'll issue what those questions are, and then set it probably for the fall.
And wow. I guess, you know, I kept hearing everyone say, okay, the end of the term is coming up. That's mm-hmm. when we saw that kind of, I think, a three-pack at least of decisions the Friday before the – or Monday before the term came up. But then we keep seeing these rulings. So I know with this Louisiana case, I think in October is or somewhere later this year is when they're going to hear this. But I was kind of confused because I thought, oh, they're done for the term. Mm-hmm. But when you talk about some of these emergencies that they need to act on quickly, I guess that's kind of what we're seeing right now.
Yeah, so, yeah. You know, the way the way that the court is run is based on its internal rules. And so during a term, which begins the first Monday of October and ends at the end of, it's like the last Friday of June, then in between that, they'll have the same schedule where they'll say, okay, we're going to hear oral arguments the first half of the term. I went down the rabbit hole. And that's the first half of the term, Monday, Tuesday, we'll hear oral arguments. Wednesday, Friday, we'll have these conferences where we'll decide and then issue, you know, who's doing what, and then start putting them together. But there's always somebody on. Okay, so, you know, if there is an emergency appeal of, say, a capital murder execution, to execute a capital murder, there's somebody who can take a call.
So, you go to a restaurant in the middle of the night, it's got a manager on duty.
Right.
Somebody's there.
Yes.
You're going to get your hash browns settled down.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, your hash browns might come out, you know, in a couple of days. But, you know, yeah, it could be bad. But, yeah. And, you know, I think this bears on saying, too, in the process of writing these opinions, the majority opinion of the court is just that. It is the majority of the court. And so what you have in these conferences is they say, okay, they start with a chief and they go all the way down to the by seniority to the least tenured person. Mm-hmm. In this case, it's Justice Jackson. And they say, here's how we're voting. Well, then they circulate the opinion. And if Justice Roberts is in the majority, as is Justice Kavanaugh or whoever, Barrett Jones or whomever, then Amy Coney Barrett, not Barrett Jones.
He was a good player.
He was a great player. And, you know, I'm still thinking Alabama football recruiting and Kalen DeBoer is killing it right now.
Yeah, he is.
Sorry, Don. But so if they're in the majority, they'll write a draft opinion and circulate it and say, you know, Justice Kavanaugh may go, that's not going far enough, or that goes too far, and I'm not going to sign off on that. And so what they do is they mold the opinion to get to where five or more of the justices agree, and that's where you get concurrences, where people say, hey, I'm in the majority, I agree with what happened, but I disagree with the rationale, or I think it should have gone farther or not as far. And that's where dissents then come in. I'm in the minority. I didn't win, but here's why I think that's wrong.
So the nuance of it all. Nuance, I should say, of it all.
Absolutely.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And when we get back from the break, I do want to talk about the nationwide injunctions case, too. But before that, what you've described to me with this Supreme Court, I knew they worked hard. But I don't know how they have enough hours in the day for all of this. I mean, they are humans, even though their rulings are so important. But kind of workplace beefs. I mean, everyone has one, and those have been showing up a little bit more. And we've seen, you know, the liberal-leaning justices go after especially the Herman Thomas's sort and a lot of their dissents. But you have Ketanji Brown Jackson has been getting the heat from even some of the left-leaning justices. It's, I guess, even in the Supreme Court, they have some workplace disagreements.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because, you know, they're usually so deferential to each other, and, you know, just like part of the tradition of the at the conferences, they all shake hands before they start, and it's like, hey, we're all
before they knife each other.
Yeah, well, exactly. But I mean, there has been an uptick in the rhetoric, I think, particularly in the CASA case, calling out Justice Jackson by name. Interestingly, though, you talk about like the numbers. It was 10.7% of the cases that came out of that 58 opinions that came out were a 6-3 split on ideological lines.
Interesting.
So, yeah, I would have thought that was more.
Yeah, it's portrayed in the media. It's going to be more. We'll continue with Brian Comer, including this question I've got for him. Why is the law so screwy? H1, it's like it's driving him crazy to get ready for this segment because he's got to do all this homework. I feel bad for him.
Brian Comer with Tobias Comer Law. We'll continue. Text us 251-343-0106.
Morning from Dan and Dalton, FM Talk 106.5.
There I am, talking with Brian Comer with Tobias and Comer Law. He's trying his best to drill into Dan and I's brain a little bit about how these opinions and rulings from the Supreme Court.
You've got about 2/3 of an inch deep on me so far.
So
that's it.
I know a big one that folks were waiting on. And once the executive order started coming from Trump, once he got into office, we started seeing immediate injunctions across the country.
Right.
And finally, at the end of June, they issued a decision. And this was billed as a big win for Trump. I think it was Alito who said, well, while maybe the courts don't have this kind of power or shouldn't have this kind of power, we may see in another way. Like a workaround where people will still be able to kind of fight some of these executive orders, but kind of explain what their decision was with Trump versus CASA.
Okay, so this is exactly what everybody wants to hear, a discussion of the historical context of equitable remedies.
Oh, yeah.
And that's really what we're talking about here. Obviously, the substantive issue from this is the naturalization situation of someone born here, but that specifically was not addressed in this opinion. This is truly a procedural question of what power does a district court have relative to its equitable remedies. And an equitable remedy, what we do at our practice is legal remedies mostly, and we have the ability to seek equitable remedies. But an equitable remedy is a court-ordered solution in a legal dispute that's not primarily focused on awarding money damages. It aims to achieve a fair and just, i.e. equitable outcome by compelling a party to do something, to refrain from doing something, or restore something to its rightful owner. And Justice Barrett wrote the opinion of the court, and she actually noted in here at the very beginning that the application, the thing that they were looking at, does not raise, and thus we do not address the question of whether the executive order violates the Citizenship Clause of the 14th Amendment or the Nationality Act. The issue before us is one of remedy, whether under the Judiciary Act of 1789, as Dan remembers fondly, federal courts have equitable authority to issue universal injunctions.
Raised hell that day.
I know. And that's what we're talking about here. And this is strict construction at its core, right? So what they did is they said, all right, what are the roots of this equitable relief? And to do that, they had to go all the way back literally to the very first Congress, which enacted the Judiciary Act of 1789.
And it's amazing.
It is. And so in the Constitutional Convention, and y'all may recall that it was enacted and it was ratified in 1789, the very first Congress comes out, and all that Article 3 of the Constitution said was that there shall be a Supreme Court of the United States and any other inferior courts as Congress deems just. Mm-hmm. And so what Congress did in that act, and actually White Horse Harry Lee brought it out of committee, and then the third Chief Justice is the one who got its passage ensured. And so what they did is they said, all right, we're going to create these other courts, and it conferred this power on the courts of equity. And so they said, all right, if we're going to go get a redress like this, how do we do it? And that's what they ultimately did. And the Supreme Court said, look, back in the day, we got to look back to England to see, because this all originated from England and the Crown and what it was able to do, and something there called the Chancery Court, which is what then provided the equitable relief. And so they basically looked at it and said, hey, back in England, at the time our country was founded, was there such thing as a nationwide injunction? And the answer was no. And so, you know, Barrett goes through a very lengthy process of going through, you know, cases from the 1800s and all this, but basically this has been something that has been on the forefront, particularly of the more conservative-leaning justices. She cites two concurrences from Justice Gorsuch, from Justice Thomas, Alito, Kavanaugh, herself, where everyone was raising, if universal injunctions' popularity continues, this court must address their legality. And it's interesting, she has this quote and says, it's easy to see why it must be addressed. By the end of the Biden administration, We had reached a state of affairs where almost every major presidential act was immediately frozen by a federal district court.
Wow.
And that's true. And solicitors general, that is the person who represents the United States of America at the Supreme Court, has argued this across, it doesn't matter what administration it is. Biden's solicitor general did it. Trump's solicitor general did it and said, hey, we've got to stop this because essentially you're freezing presidential authority.
Yeah.
By picking a district court, a trial judge, in a district that might be leaning differently than what the party in power is.
But they're choosing that court.
Basically, yes. Yeah.
That is, I feel like we've only touched the surface because we have. We've got to get you back on here soon to go into more detail, because I know they're talking also about class actions and maybe kind of being a workaround to that nationwide injunction, some form or fashion. But Brian Comer with Tobias and Comer Law, another fantastic job letting us know. TobiasComerLaw.com, and that number 251-432-5001. Thank you so much, Brian.
Thanks for having me, guys.